Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, John Russell, and Steve Ember. But first, this report with help from Ann Ball. Education officials and industry experts are debating the future of online learning. The discussion is important because recently, hundreds of universities in the United States have moved classes online because of the spread of the new coronavirus. For Asha Choksi, the rise of internet-based or online study programs has led to major improvements in higher education. What it's done is, it's actually given a lot more power to students in terms of how, when, and where they learn, the head of research for Pearson Education told VOA. Her company supervises online learning programs. Colleges and universities worldwide have been looking for ways to provide high-quality education off-campus and outside of normal business hours. The decision by many schools in the U.S. to suspend in-person classes during the recent coronavirus crisis has shown how important online teaching can be. And demand for such programs is increasing. The financial advising company Titan Partners valued the online program management industry at over $1.5 billion in 2015.
Choksi, however, argues that her company is creating a path to higher education for people who might not have been able to get a degree otherwise. Pearson Education is one of a growing number of companies that have partnered with schools to create online study aids and full degree programs. Classes meet online through video conferencing. In this way, students are able to communicate with each other and their professors, even when they are far away from school. Online learning also permits older students who work full-time and support families to work on their education in their free time. It can be helpful for people who might have difficulty coming to a college campus, such as disabled students or those who live far from any college or university. However, recent research suggests the majority of college students and professors prefer in-person instruction. In addition, some experts are concerned that companies supervising online learning programs are not clear about the policies they have with the schools they serve. Last year, the EDUCAUSE Center for Analysis and Research published two opinion studies on online higher education programs. Researchers asked over 40,000 American undergraduate students and 9,500 professors what they thought about these programs. In both groups, at least 70% of people said they prefer in-person instruction.
Students see in-class lectures as opportunities to engage with instructors, peers, and content, the researchers wrote. Faculty satisfaction with the overall technology experience has declined. In-person learning is especially important in fields like healthcare and teaching. Online education can never really take its place, said Stephanie Hall. She is a fellow with the independent policy research group, the Century Foundation. Students need to experience what it is they're learning about, reading about, or hearing about in the classroom. And I don't know yet the degree to which technology can facilitate that, said Hall. She added that it is not just the user experience that is the issue. Her organization has released several studies about a number of online program managers, known as OPMs. These include companies such as Pearson Education, 2U, and Academic Partnerships. When schools make agreements with OPMs to run their online programs, they often do not make important information available to students, Hall said. This includes how much control the company has over the design of the program, or whether the faculty leading the classes were involved in their design.
In addition, many colleges and universities advertise online programs as a low-cost opportunity for students. But in some cases, students attending in-person classes get financial aid and online students do not. This is another detail which many schools do not make clear to students. Hall argues that rules for these programs are very limited. She said schools should be required to give all of this information to students. She also believes agreements between the schools and companies are too long and should be renewed each year. In this way, companies will improve to keep the contract. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Pete Musto.
And now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Sometimes in life, you need to act quickly. Thinking too much about a problem does not always help. It can hold us back. We have expressions that describe this way of thinking. No time like the present. A rolling stone gathers no moss. Just do it. But sometimes, slower is better. Many things in life require careful thought and preparation. Sometimes we need to be cautious and take precautions. A great expression for that kind of behavior is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. This saying comes to us from Benjamin Franklin. In addition to being a writer, Franklin was a printer, political thinker, politician, scientist, inventor, and diplomat. He was also one of the founding fathers of the United States. So he was a busy man. But Franklin still found time to write and offer his advice to others. If he were alive today, he could probably make a good living as a life coach. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is one of his most famous sayings. Now, Franklin lived during the 1700s, before the metric system took effect in Europe. The word ounce means something really small, just 2/100ths of a kilogram to be exact. So his expression meant that when dealing with a problem, spending a small amount of time and effort early on is a good investment. It can save you more trouble in the end. For example, if a country announces strong measures for containing a virus, we could say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It is better to take severe precautions than to suffer severe consequences later. Word historians say that when Franklin first used this expression, he was not talking about disease, but rather fire prevention. During a visit to Boston in 1733, Franklin was impressed with the city's fire prevention methods. He tried to bring some of these practices to the city of Philadelphia, where he lived. Supposedly, Franklin sent an unsigned letter to his own newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette. Published on February 4, 1735, his letter, Protection of Towns from Fire, began with the expression, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Then he wrote about how a city should prepare itself for a fire. From protecting yourself against sickness to preventing a house fire, this expression can be used in serious situations. It is a fixed expression, meaning we don't change the wording when we use it. We simply repeat it as is. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. The next time you want to take care and avoid problems down the road, use the expressions you heard here. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
A new exhibition celebrates the life of Florence Nightingale, an English woman whose ideas about cleanliness are important to this day. The exhibit can be seen at the Florence Nightingale Museum at St. Thomas's Hospital in London. It marks the 200th anniversary of Nightingale's birth. The exhibit tells the story of how she overcame difficulties to become the world's most famous nurse. The show recreates her bedroom, lets visitors hear a recording of her voice, and even smell the perfume she wore. Fiona Hibberts is a nursing consultant and works for the hospital's Nightingale Academy. She described Nightingale's work as really, really important to future generations. Obviously, she was a forceful leader, Hibbert said, and we need clear, visible, strong leadership today, and certainly in modern nursing. The exhibition, called Nightingale in 200 Objects, People, and Places, will continue for a year. St. Thomas's is one of a small number of hospitals in Britain with an area for the treatment of coronavirus patients. The emphasis on sanitation, good hygiene, fresh air, exercise, good food, no matter how much we advance, those fundamental foundational principles of Florence are still very much the basis of modern nursing, Hibberts noted. She added, it's the same old message, wash your hands. Nightingale became world famous after she and a small team of medical workers traveled to modern-day Istanbul during the Crimean War. It was fought mainly on the Crimean Peninsula in the middle of the 1850s. Nightingale helped treat British soldiers wounded in the fighting. In an unclean hospital, she saw thousands of soldiers die from infectious diseases. Their deaths led to her decision to try to improve conditions. The lamp she used when visiting patients at night is on show at the exhibition, as is the nurse's uniform she created. Yvonne Moores is chair of the Florence Nightingale Foundation and Britain's former national chief nursing officer. If Florence Nightingale herself was here, she would be supporting all that's being said at the moment. She was absolutely into infection control, hand washing, being very observant, she said. Nightingale continued to work and to write late into old age. She died in 1920 at the age of 90. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In December 1941, the United States was at war. It declared war against Japan after Japanese pilots attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. A few days later, Germany and Italy declared war against the United States. President Franklin Roosevelt quickly decided that America could not fight major campaigns in the Pacific and in Europe at the same time. He and his advisors decided to fight first against the Germans and Italians. Then, when victory in Europe seemed sure, the United States could turn to fight the Japanese in Asia. This left the Japanese free to extend their power throughout Asia and the Western Pacific. Soon after the attack at Hawaii, Japanese forces invaded Hong Kong, Malaya, and the Philippines. American forces in the Philippines suffered heavy losses, and Manila fell to Japanese troops. In February 1942, Japan's forces won a great victory against the British in Singapore. Japanese forces marched into Burma. They attacked Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, and captured the Andaman Islands in the Bay of Bengal. The Japanese military forces seemed too strong to stop. President Roosevelt sent some forces to the Pacific, and he began to rebuild the American naval forces destroyed at Pearl Harbor. But he sent most of America's military strength to Europe. The United States rushed troops and war equipment to help Britain survive against Adolf Hitler's Germany. American military leaders wanted to fight Germany quickly by launching an attack across the English Channel. But British Prime Minister Winston Churchill opposed this. He and others feared such an invasion might fail. So British and American forces attacked Italian and German occupation troops in North Africa. They defeated them and then crossed the Mediterranean Sea to attack enemy forces in Sicily. Within weeks, they pushed the Germans out of Sicily to the Italian mainland. The Allied invasion of Italy followed. Hitler could not strengthen his forces in North Africa and Italy because Germany also was fighting hard in the Soviet Union. Hitler's decision early in the war to attack the Soviet Union was a serious mistake. It divided his men and materials. His plan was to defeat Soviet forces quickly with one strong attack. But he failed, and his failure cost him valuable troops and supplies that might have helped him win the battles for North Africa and Italy. Germany's attack on the Soviet Union began with great success. In the middle of 1941,
a German force of more than 3 million men invaded the Soviet Union. It captured the Ukraine, took control of Kiev, and marched deep into Russia. The situation changed the following year. Soviet forces under Marshal Georgi Zhukov won a fierce battle for the city of Stalingrad, now Volgograd. A great many German soldiers died from cold and hunger during the bitter winter months that followed. Zhukov's forces attacked the German troops and pushed back the invaders. Other Soviet troops forced the Germans away from the city of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. By the middle of 1944, German forces throughout the Soviet Union were retreating, and Soviet forces were preparing to push them over the border and invade Germany themselves. The fighting came at a terrible cost. Huge numbers of soldiers and civilians were killed. The fighting in World War II was not limited to land. Battles were also being fought on the sea. The main goal of the German Navy during the war was to prevent the United States from sending ships to Britain with war materials, food, and troops. At first, the Germans were very successful. There was hunger in Britain in 1941 because so few ships could cross the North Atlantic with food. German submarines were the greatest danger to ships crossing the Atlantic. These U-boats, as the Germans called them, could hide below the surface and attack without warning. The threat from German submarines did not ease until new technology was developed in 1943. Allied scientists improved sonar and radar systems that helped find submarines on the surface and underwater. More of the enemy submarines were found and destroyed. The Allies slowly gained control of the Atlantic. Allied and German warships fought a number of traditional naval battles, but airplanes came to play an increasingly important part in the fighting at sea. British ships, with the help of planes launched from an aircraft carrier, destroyed a powerful German battleship, the Bismarck, on May 27, 1941. The most famous air battle of the war in Europe took place during the summer and autumn of the previous year. It was known as the Battle of Britain. It got its name from a speech to Parliament by Prime Minister Churchill following the evacuation of British and French forces from Dunkirk.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. In the House of Commons this afternoon, the Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill, said, "What General Vagar called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin."
It was the most extensive aerial bombing yet in the war. It was also the first battle to be fought entirely in the air. German Stuka dive bombers attacked shipping centers, areas of political importance, airfields, and airplane factories.
Luftwaffe pilots in their Messerschmitts battled the Hurricanes and Spitfires of the Royal Air Force. While the flying skills of the German and British pilots were well matched, it was ultimately the greater maneuverability of the British Spitfire that won the long months of battle over the English Channel. The British victory in the air helped prevent Operation Sea Lion, a planned German invasion of Britain. In May of 1942, Britain's Royal Air Force carried out an attack on Germany with 1,000 bombers. It was just the first of many bombing runs over Germany and German-occupied areas by the air forces of Britain and the United States. The planes bombed German military and industrial centers. They also bombed civilian targets in an effort to demonstrate to the German people the price of Germany's aggression. The German cities of Cologne, Dresden, and Hamburg suffered widespread destruction. The Allied bombing attacks continued until the war's end in 1945. Hitler's victories in the early months of the war had struck fear into the hearts of people throughout the world. Hitler and his Axis allies had won battle after battle. They had captured most of Western Europe and invaded the Soviet Union. They had seized North Africa, and their submarines controlled the Atlantic. Germany continued to seem strong during the first months after the United States entered the war in Europe. But the situation began to change. German strength and control were greatest in November of 1942. After then, the mighty German military machine began to slow down. Germany and its Axis partner, Italy, suffered serious losses in the first 6 months of 1943. German losses were extremely heavy in the Soviet Union. 160,000 German troops died at Stalingrad, and more than 110,000 surrendered. American and British forces captured 250,000 German and Italian troops in North Africa. Many more thousands were killed or captured in Sicily and the Italian mainland. German submarines were being destroyed in the North Atlantic, allowing more Allied troops and supplies to reach Britain. By the end of 1943, Hitler and his armies no longer seemed so strong. But German forces continued to occupy France, Belgium, and much of the rest of Western Europe. Now the time had come for the Allies to invade German-held Europe from Britain. Allied forces planned the greatest military invasion in history to break the German control of Europe and win the war.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.